You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 25th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, hey, hey.
Okay. What's happening?
What's happening? Hey, rerun.
The ectomorph, the endomorph, and the mesomorph.
Gosh, that must be deeply stored somewhere in my brain. I can't believe I pulled that out.
Well, guess what was happening 104 years ago today?
What was happening 104 years ago today?
The great big space kablooey?
I don't know that I'd say a space kablooey, because technically it kablooeyed in the Earth's atmosphere. But yes, on June 30th, 1908, something exploded near the Tunguska River in Russia. And that is most likely to have been a meteoroid that exploded in midair and left a ton of tons of trees leveled and on fire and then stripped, of course.
That's 80 million trees, by the way. Lots of trees.
That's a good factoid. I have a few more. The explosion was approximately 1,000 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
Much less deadly, though.
I found a website that said it was equivalent to 185 Hiroshima bombs. So,
maybe
so somewhere in there.
Yeah, but big. It was a big explosion.
Maybe 1,000 Nagasaki bombs.
And in some places, the shock wave would have been equivalent to an earthquake of 5.0 on the Richter scale.
Whoa.
Wow. That's big.
I think you mean magnitude scale, not Richter.
The area of leveled forest was about 2,000 square kilometers, or about 800 square miles.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Devastating.
This other interesting thing that I actually saw on the Wikipedia page, of all places, in 1938, a researcher did an aerial photographic survey, but the photos he got were burned in 1975 by order of Yevgeny Krinov, who was the chairman of the Committee on Meteorites of the USSR Academy of Sciences. And apparently, Krinov says he was burning them because they were a fire hazard.
He burned them. He burned them because they were a fire hazard.
Yeah.
Something's not right.
Yeah, it's possible that he actually burned them because it was a giant mystery and nobody knew the solution to it yet, and it was embarrassing to Soviet scientists, but who knows?
So there's still a bit of a controversy over what exactly exploded over Tunguska. Was it a meteoroid or a comet, basically ice with debris, or just a chunk of ice? Probably not just a chunk of ice, because there was some mineral debris discovered. But recently, Italian researchers, I think we discussed this before, but they recently published some evidence saying that they think a big chunk of whatever it was actually impacted the lake a few miles from what was believed to be ground zero.
Yeah.
And there are two lines of evidence. One is that they have some seismic evidence to say there's some big solid chunk underneath there. And second, that the silting is about 100 years worth of silt, or sediment. So that dates it about the right time as the Tunguska event. Yeah. So it doesn't sound definitive smoking gun evidence, but that they have a pretty plausible, hypothesis, and they might actually be on the trail of a big chunk of whatever it was that impacted there.
Well, what else could it possibly be, guys?
Alien ship?
It seems that right now meteoroid exploding in midair is the most popular thing, the most popular theory. But cometary fragment of ice is a big one, just because there's a chance that it would have melted, and therefore, like the old using an ice pick as the murder weapon dealy. But and also that theory fits in with a lot of reports from people at the time who said that they saw strange, blueness in the skies for the days following the explosion. It's suggested that maybe those came from the particles left in the air from a cometary fragment.
Yeah.
Okay.
According to Don Yeomans, he's a manager of the Near Earth Object Office at NASA's JPL. He said his characterization of this event is that it's the only entry of a large meteoroid we have in the modern era with first-hand accounts. which is interesting. It's the only one really that we have. We've been hit many times, but only once have we really seen something this big and, you know, have somebody eyewitness it. And some of the eyewitness accounts were interesting. One guy said, he's quoted as saying, "Suddenly in the north sky, the sky was split in two, and high above the forest, the whole northern part of the sky appeared covered with fire. At that moment, there was a bang in the sky and a mighty crash."
Wow.
He actually saw this thing. And another guy, it's amazing, this shockwave must have been pretty intense. This guy was sitting on his porch 40 miles away in Siberia, and he was hurled from his chair, and he said his shirt felt like it was on fire. Just yeah, 40 miles away.
The eyewitness reports are really interesting to read because all of them sound like they were witnessing this apocalyptic event that must have just scared the pants off of them.
It's
really interesting to have them all describe something that epic, you know. Just imagine being one of the only people in the world to have seen something like that. It's pretty incredible.
And survived to tell about it.
Yeah.
Fire, huh? Yes. I heard Prometheus stole fire from the gods.
So we are about to talk about the movie Prometheus. Uh-huh. This is a alien prequel, and we are going to talk about the science of this movie. It's a science fiction movie, and they actually refer to a lot of different little bits of science throughout the movie, and it's a very fun way to talk about the science itself. This is going to be a massive, continuous series of spoilers about the movie.
Which is why I would like to actually get off the call now because I was not able to see it this weekend.
You haven't even seen it yet?
What?
But
no, I tried. I had friends in from out of town. I couldn't get there.
All right.
Yeah, and we actually did wait a few weeks till the movie came. We didn't do this right away. I saw the movie as soon as it came out. We wanted to wait so that people who really wanted to see the movie will have had a few weeks to do so before we talked about it on the show. But if you still haven't seen it and you want to without spoilers yet, just skip over this section and then come back and listen to it once you see the movie. But if you didn't see the movie and you still want to listen to this segment, I'm just going to give you the quick overview. Some type of aliens arrive on a planet. We're meant to believe that this is the planet Earth. The alien drinks some black goo and then disintegrates and seeds the oceans with his DNA. This happened apparently at some point in the past, but we're not really – it's not clear. Is it the Earth? If it is the Earth, was this before any life evolved on the Earth? Was it just before human life evolved on the Earth? It's really not clear. Then we jump to the future, you know, to the present day. Actually, no, to about 100 years in the future when scientists are piecing together evidence of ancient alien visitors to the Earth. They go to visit the apparent location of those aliens, and they run into what turns out to be a military base of the creatures that made the aliens from the Alien movies. So that's the basic plot. So now let's go back. We could probably take the scientific gas in the order in which they appear in the movie, or at least the big ones. So, you know, part of the problem with my problem with the movie, I mean, I don't mind having things being ambiguous and mysterious. That's part of good storytelling and science fiction. You don't need to know exactly why Hal went mental against the astronauts in 2001. That's fine. You know, but it has to make some basic sense. Now, the problem is that I can't find any way to make sense of the basic premise that some alien seeded his DNA on this planet, and that somehow resulted in us.
Right.
Looking exactly like them with
a perfect 100% match
DNA correlation.
Well, it's not just that, Steve. It's that it's rewriting proven science that is globally accepted by those that believe in science. So the issue here is that right out of the gate, from the word go, the movie is starting with a premise that's going to rub a lot of the science fiction fans wrong. Like, it's taking some of your core audience and basically saying, hey, you know, for whatever reasons, I'm going to insult you right now.
Right. So the thing is, I get it. It would be okay if it were just it's planting its DNA on the prebiotic Earth. And that DNA eventually will evolve into all life on Earth, because we really are not sure how the first self-replicating molecules got onto the Earth. It could have been through panspermia. It could have, you know, assembled, self-assembled on the Earth, and there are theories as to how that could have happened. But it actually isn't against established, proven science that the Earth was seeded with molecules, with organic or self-replicating molecules 4 billion years ago, or 3.5 billion years ago.
Not fully formed DNA, though.
Well, even DNA, that's a little bit of a stretch, but even that wouldn't be an assault on what we know happened. But here's the thing, that how would that lead 3.5 billion years later to humans? Because a human's right. DNA is what was seeded. You know what I mean?
Right.
That doesn't make any sense. That's the connection that's completely missing. And
it's almost like they're suggesting two different biologies at work here. There's one that the Earth conjured up itself, which it contains everything except humans or the close ancestors of humans, and the engineers are responsible for the humans that came along on Earth. We've got two different biologies.
But that's almost worse. Yeah, that's the other option. And that's even worse, because how are they so similar to the rest of life on Earth? And clearly, humans evolved on Earth from other Earth life on Earth. We were not planted here from some other system. And so,
yeah, it would be obvious.
Yeah, so there's just no way to make the whole thing work, you know?
Right.
Well, next is what about the archaeology? In
yeah,
the caves,
that's
35,000.
I was.
That's the I other big
that
one.
That's the
so
next
annoying.
Step.
So, two of the main characters in the movie are archaeologists who uncover a cave painting in which, you know, a typical cave painting caveman is pointing at these. It was like about 5 or 6 or whatever dots on the wall, and they correlate apparently to paintings from multiple other cultures from 2,000 or so years ago. This cave painting was much older than 35,000 years. That's all that we were told. So we have different cultures painting these pictures of these 7 dots, and the archaeologists figure out that the dots are a star map.
Right.
This makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
On so many levels.
On a lot of levels. You know, the place they go to is said to be 35 light years from Earth. And even in 35,000 years, you're going to see shifts of something that relatively close to the Earth, right? That map's not going to be worth anything.
But guys, even here, and I've read a lot of stuff online about this, the star system had to be close enough that they can get there sub-light speed in 2 years.
No, there's no way they got there sub-light speed in 2 years. There's no star.
Well, not
there's no star
speed,
that we could do that. So we have to give them, and again, I have no problem with these kind of super technological gimmies in science fiction. They had to do some kind of superluminal speed. They're going through wormholes or they're gating.
Wait, Steve, never in the alien science fiction universe did they go faster
than
light.
They had to, Jay. They had to.
When? But they never said it. Maybe they had to, but it was never said or talked about. It was just in the background.
But I'm willing to give that to them, because it would take thousands, tens of thousands of years to get to the nearest stars sublight. Just to, you know what I mean? At anything with any reasonable acceleration.
Now, wait a second. If they're going at relativistic speeds, maybe it's 2 years ship time. Who knows what Earth time would be, although it would be kind of silly, you know, to get back to Earth and have it be 100,000 years later. That would be really silly if you plan on going back to Earth. But that's
none
just
of it works.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking Earth time. Ship time could be much shorter, although it would still be more than 2 years, I believe. But then it would be hundreds or thousands of years on Earth time. It just doesn't fit the storyline. So, okay, we'll give that to them. They do some kind of faster than light travel. But here's the thing. Evan already alluded to the fact that, all right, over 30,000 years, the location of any stars in our vicinity would shift. They wouldn't be where they were. A star map that's more than 35,000 years old would be worthless. I also think the whole concept of just any two-dimensional pattern of dots being a star map that's going to direct us to a specific cluster of stars, we would have to assume that it was as seen from the perspective of the Earth. We wouldn't really know. Are the stars actually close together, or are they just only lined up in one direction? It's just not enough information. It's just they should have had some more complicated graphic or glyph that's just more than 5 dots. You know?
Yeah.
Yep. Agreed.
It sounds like they whipped together that idea of, oh, let's do 5 dots in 1 20-minute meeting. Yeah, let's just do that.
It's exactly what happened, Bob. It sounds like people came up with it that are science fiction fans but don't get science. Oh, yeah, it'll be these five stars.
It'll be a star map, yeah.
Yeah, it's so basic. It's like, you know, this that idea is 30 years old.
Yeah, exactly. That's lazy old school writing. And then their discussion of it was confused. They said, yeah, so we found the system, meaning, what do you mean the system? There's five stars here. And it said, and there's a sun in the system, or there's a sun in one of them. What do you mean there's a sun in one of them? Aren't these all suns?
You don't have much of a system without a sun anyway. Like, if you have a system, implies that there's a sun in there.
Yeah, and somebody commented, it could have meant that there was a planetary system around one of the stars making it a sun, but it's still not the right nomenclature. And why didn't they say, and one of these stars has a planetary system around it?
That's it.
That's,
quick fix.
That's what they, if they meant that, that's what they should have said. That part I found totally.
So 2 years goes by. Now, an incredibly rich guy hires these two scientists to basically lead up a mission to go to the planet and find the engineers.
Yeah, the engineers are the alien creatures who made humans somehow.
Oh, with an android. There's an android on the team, too.
Best part of the movie, by the way, was the android.
Yeah, he was cool.
First of all, I have to say, I enjoyed watching the movie. It was gorgeous to watch. I mean, just the images and everything were fabulous. I think it's worth seeing. The annoying parts are almost fun to be annoyed at. You know, we like picking apart movies like this. The science wasn't the only problem. There were some major problems with the writing. I hated the way the characters were written. We can get this out of the way right now. One big problem was most of the main characters in the movie were scientists that were handpicked to go on this trillion-dollar mission to discover not only the first contact with alien life, but the aliens who may have been responsible for humanity or life on Earth, and who clearly had visited Earth and left a message for us to follow to go find them. Huge mission, right? And all the scientists are buffoons.
Every last one of them.
Plus, they sign up for a 4-year mission without knowing the details of what the hell they're doing. Yeah, I'll do it. Well, wouldn't you ask for some details? Like, what's going on?
The geologist was just in it for the money, like he said.
Yeah. I'm just in it for the money.
Really good.
Cheap.
And then, is that why they picked you for this mission?
Which one do you want to start?
I mean, they're all terrible. So they get on this. It's actually a moon of like a ringed gas giant. Although Bob and I were talking about the fact that the tidal forces on this moon would have been enormous.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they would have been nasty. Nothing really. I mean, the surface would have overturned itself in and out over the millennia. There really wouldn't be much on the surface. The tidal forces would have been nasty. It would have been just basically a volcanic planet. I would guess from the proximity to its primary.
Maybe it was farther away than it might have seemed, but
but it looked good.
Perhaps, but yeah, it was just something that I noticed. I was like, yeah,
total nightmare to people
to scientists before while they're writing the movie rather than afterwards,
right? Or talk to us. Yeah. We'll help you out.
See, that's the thing. They probably
Ridley
did,
next time call us, please. So listen. The scientists get to this planet. They find that there's artifacts, and they essentially go into this big beehive like complex. Or a working structure. They're inside this place. The planet apparently has oxygen. I'm calling it a planet. It's really a moon, but it's a world that people were on. Mm-hmm. But
with that 1G, apparently.
Very, very convenient. 1G, perfect. Very nice. And
always.
It had oxygen, even though there didn't appear to be that much life on it. But the carbon dioxide level was too high for humans to breathe. They would pass out from the CO2. So they had to have helmets on. And apparently the atmosphere inside the structure was breathable. So now the scientists who are on a planet with alien life, what do they do? They take their helmets off.
Throw their helmet off.
Well, the air's breathable. Yeah. The air's breathable.
How else would we know?
What else would we really be in isolation for? You know,
gee, microbes, bacteria.
Yeah. How about an airborne infection? Hello.
Of course, anything, guys, anything. And this is one of those big defining moments in this movie and in all science fiction movies, the big take the helmet off moment. It's right? It's such an iconic mistake to make. Don't take your helmet off. It never leads to anything good, number one. And number two, every single time somebody takes their helmet off, they shouldn't.
But Jay, you don't understand. It lends dialogue to the people who have to say, no, don't take your helmet off. You shouldn't. I'm taking my helmet off anyways.
Wait, now, Steve, you missed. I'm sorry. I have to jump back to a moment in the movie you missed because it happens to be the big defining, this movie is crap moment for me. Okay? So it's when the lead scientist says that the circles they found on all the drawings is not a star map, but it's actually an invitation from the engineers who created the human race, right? Uh-huh. And they cap it off when she's asked how she knows that information is correct. She says she doesn't know. It's what she chooses to believe. And apparently that's good enough for all the other scientists on board because not one of them instantly pukes at that moment and says something like, hey, 300 years of science is now thrown away because you found an invitation. You know, and then on top of that, I'll even go one step further. The truly profound sadness of the whole thing is that according to the movie, she's right. She's actually right. All of that horrible thinking and lack of reasoning is correct in this ridiculous universe.
And it actually wasn't a leap to say that, you know, if you buy the whole star map thing and, you know, it was left obviously with multiple cultures that we would see the pattern and everything, that they intended us to follow it. I mean, that's what she was saying. And that's actually fine that she concluded that. But the evidence and the logic led you to that, not just I choose to believe it, I have faith in it. And the fact that that statement went unchallenged by a room full of scientists created the sense that these characters were not behaving like real scientists. Not that, you know, most of the time they weren't behaving like real human beings, let alone scientists. They were doing things that were just stupid and were out of character and were completely inconsistent. The character writing was just terrible. So yeah, I agree with you, Jay. It's part of what we're talking about. The getting back to the taking the helmet off thing. The other thing is that you had no sense from the way these people were behaving of any training or seriousness. There was no protocol. Wouldn't there be an elaborate protocol in terms of not getting infected when you're on a planet that you have a high – you're there because you think there's alien life there. And they would have some kind of protocol in place. But there was nothing. They were like high school kids exploring an abandoned building. You know what I mean? It was just no sense that these people knew what they were doing or had any training or were prepared for this at all.
Right, the height of that lack of protocol comes about 15 minutes further into the movie when two of the scientists get stuck in another part of like the spaceship slash monument type deal, whatever the hell they're in. And they're in there overnight because all the other scientists went back to the ship, but they got lost and they get stuck in there, which is ridiculous that the guy got lost in the first place.
Yeah, so we have to pause, all right, because this is another bit about not behaving like scientists. This is the geologist guy who's like, oh, I'm just here for the money. I'm a tough guy. Now he turns into a little pansy because he first of all, he bugs out. He wants to bug out because they found a dead body. Oh, my God. They found a dead body. I'm so scared. I'm getting out of here. Screw you guys. I'm going back to the ship. This is also the guy now who brought these the laser tracking devices that are in the process of completely mapping this entire structure. This is the guy who gets lost. The guy with the map, the 3D laser-generated map of the entire structure, he's the guy who gets lost.
Hey, he's just in it for the money, Steve. Come on.
Yeah. All right, so now these guys are in this room. They're in the room that has like all of these
little pods
that are reminiscent of Alien.
With the eggs,
the room with all the pods with the eggs that have the laser light cover extender or whatever. So that goo is actually the stuff that changes biology. Okay, and there's worms on this planet that they show that are crawling around, and the worms get in the goo, and the goo turns the worms into the alien worms, right?
Like
the,
got that.
It's what an alien would be if it impregnated a worm. So the worm very quickly grows into this big worm. And the biologist of the crew, if you don't know what a biologist is, I'll remind you, it's the guy that understands, oh, I don't know, biology, sees an alien worm thing come up. And his initial reaction is, oh, look how cute it is.
It doesn't look like a worm. it's the size of a beefy cobra, and it adopts the stance and the attitude of a cobra, flaring its head, hissing. It's obviously obviously a threatening display. And this guy's go, oh, look at the cute little animal. I mean, it was... Look. Like it was a puppy.
Coochie coo. Like,
this is the guy who were, this is. So these are the two guys who were leaving because they saw a dead body and they were freaked out by it. And now he wants to play, you know, to cuddle up with a hissing space cobra,
an alien. I don't care if you see an alien and it looks like a little teddy bear. You run. It's an alien, for Christ's sake. The thing, you know, who knows what's going on?
That's like whatever you guys remember. Galaxy Quest?
Yeah.
The cute little guy. Yeah. Look at the cute little guys, and they bare their teeth, and they're horrible carnivores. Exactly. They're alien. You don't know what they are. You don't know the millions of threats that that thing could have evolved. And to assume – because the guy's a biologist, so he must think all life forms are cuddly, even if they're carnivores. That, again – it's like the guy wasn't even behaving like a human being, let alone a biologist handpicked to be the first biologist to study alien life.
And was that your guy's first moment of disgust with the movie? Because that was it for me.
Yeah.
That is where I became like, wow. Like,
it was
they are really insulting my intelligence right now as a movie goer.
I agree with you. Ed. That was – I think you and I were sitting together, and I remember us sharing a look at that moment along with
– We sighed and we were like – hands on our foreheads like, what are they doing?
This is a really good example of – what I like to call John Carpenter's The Thing, set the bar, and you have to from that moment forward, when that movie was created in the 80s, you have to live up to that movie. And here's why. The reason why that movie was insanely successful, where this movie blatantly fails, is everybody in The Thing did exactly what regular people would do. They were scared. They were cautious. They didn't really do anything stupid. They tried to talk about things. They tried to do the best job that they can, and it was obvious that they were all relatively intelligent.
Yeah, they did a good job, actually. That's the thing that it made the movie more scary, because the people in the movie were like really being proactive and intelligent, and they still got screwed. Whereas in this movie, like, they're dead because they're stupid and they deserve to be dead.
That's right. Yeah, you actually at some point you just start going, first off, you don't care about any of the characters, but when you don't care about characters in a movie, sometimes you start pitching for the other team. Then you're like, go get him, alien. Yeah.
Right.
Kill him. He's an idiot. I hate that guy.
Yeah.
Oh, here's
the part where the acid gets sprayed in his face. Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go. Another along the theme of scientists acting out of character. So the archaeologist gets infected with a space worm. He's looking in the mirror. A space worm crawls out of his eye.
Yeah.
So clearly taking off the helmet was not a good idea. He's infected. And he doesn't mention it to anybody. And there's no isolation protocol.
Not.
There's no, you know, he looked a little concerned for a moment there, but then I guess he figured everything was okay.
Oh yeah, I'm fine.
And it wasn't the helmet, though, that got him.
I know, but he didn't know that. At this point, he should be thinking, geez, I guess I shouldn't have taken my helmet off. Not, oh, I wonder if the android spiked my drink with aliens deliberately.
Yeah, and they take their helmets off again the next day. He lets his wife, who he loves, take off her helmet again.
Yeah.
What about the... Yeah, like the head they put in the bag.
So, yeah, they find a decapitated head of one of the aliens who, they're humanoid. Their DNA is quote-unquote identical to human DNA, but they're like 8 feet, 9 feet tall, and they're not exactly identical to humans. So anyway, they find the decapitated head. They mention that it's remarkably well-preserved, but they don't really offer any reasonable explanation for why the thing is fresh. It's not just well-preserved. Mm-hmm. It's fresh.
Like, it's pliable, yeah.
It's like living tissue, fresh. And they're able to trick it into thinking it's alive by stimulating its locus coeruleus. So I guess they just chose a random name of a part of the brain to stimulate. Let's look up a brain. Now, locus coeruleus, we'll go with that one, you know.
Do a Google search quick.
And that, yeah, so the
brain parts.
So they stick like this meat tenderizer type of prong into the head, and its eyes open up, and it gets a horrified look on its face, and then, for no reason,
it explodes.
The head explodes.
Yeah. Just because, you know. Because it was scared.
Yeah.
Well, and there was no alien in it. Yeah. It just exploded. It's like, well, why?
It was cool, I guess.
Something's got to blow up.
Because it was mad. It was mad that they woke it up, and I'm not kidding when I say that.
All right.
I'm not kidding.
One little thing. At one point, the scientists throw out the line that they're going to carbon 14 date the remains, right? It was the alien that they found. Now, all right, background on how carbon 14 dating works. Carbon 14 is an isotope of carbon 12, which is the typical isotope. It's usually formed by cosmic rays colliding with nitrogen atoms in the atmosphere, converting the nitrogen atom into carbon 14. It's incorporated into carbon dioxide, which gets incorporated into plants, which then get eaten by animals. So living creatures on Earth will have the same ratio of carbon in their bodies as the ratio of carbon 14 to 12 in the atmosphere of the planet, sort of in the steady state. And then when you die, the carbon 14, now you're not replenishing your carbon 14 anymore. So the carbon 14 spontaneously decays back into nitrogen. But the carbon 12 is stable. So the ratio of carbon 14 to carbon 12 is, we know the starting point because we know what the ratio is in the atmosphere. And then the amount of carbon 14 will decrease according to the half-life, which is about 5,000 years, of carbon 14 decaying into nitrogen. So in order to do carbon 14 dating, you need to know what the steady state ratio of carbon 14 to carbon 12 is. And they make no mention of calibrating the carbon 14 dating to this world, this moon. Further, we have no idea what the aliens were eating. We don't know if they were eating plants or animals derived from this planet's atmosphere, or if they brought food with them and what that ratio was. They really don't have any way of knowing how to calibrate the carbon 14 dating. You can't just apply it to this, you know, to organic matter on an alien world in an unusual situation that you have no idea about.
And that's something that any scientist would have picked up if they just ran this by anybody. You know, at the very least, they could have come up with something different, you know, a different element, some other little bit of techno babble that would sell the scene, but not make it scientifically stupid.
Yeah.
See, but my fear here is that Ridley Scott and his team did that. They did consult scientists. They did get the correct ideas of these things, but they dismissed them and they decided to go a different direction because it wasn't cool enough in their minds.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened.
Oh boy!
Because wait, what scientists? Did the Ridley Scott and the Prometheus crew find the most incompetent scientists in the world and gather them together to be the scientific consultants for this movie?
Yeah, I think they just didn't listen to whatever consultants.
They just didn't listen.
But it wouldn't have taken. It's not like it was an artistic thing. So you have the guy say, "Oh, I'm carbon 14 dating this, assuming my calibrations are correct to this planet." You know, just throw something out there so that anybody who knows what it is won't be insulted by it, or we go, "Oh, wow, they actually thought of it. That's cool." And if you don't know what it is, it just sounds like techno babble, which lends to the atmosphere of the movie. That's, you know, it's generally a good idea to write to sort of the most knowledgeable or the deepest level of your audience, or to always be one notch better, you know, than that. But you never want to write on a level that is more ignorant than your audience is going to be. And, you know, while, you know, a general audience may not pick up on a lot of these things, this is a science fiction movie. A lot of science nerds are going to watch it, you know, and pick it apart, which is what's been happening. All right. We have to get to some of the medical crap in the movie.
Well, that was all good.
Yeah, so the main character, who is the wife of the guy with the space worm who got infected by the android, they have sex, and apparently that's enough to inseminate her with alien genetic material. So she's rapidly growing an alien inside of her womb. She discovers this. Fortunately, the ship has an automated surgical unit. You know, there's like a little box you climb into it. The computer and it has attachments, whatever, that will do surgery on you, right?
this is my favorite little technological device. It was really cool. You plug in, you know, what kind of problem do you have? You know, I have a penetrating wound. You know, I've got a sty in my eyelid. Whatever, you go in there, and these robotic arms take care of your problem, and from slicing into you and doing whatever it takes. And it's really cool, and I really love that scene. Except,
well, the execution was crap. You know, like, first of all, incorporate some diagnostics. You know, the thing is that other than the fact that this was all automated, the technology on display was very 2012. You know what I mean? It was basic. It was automated current day surgery. You know, it wasn't the kind of surgery you'd expect to be happening 100 years from now.
Right. That is true. It was a little simple, and it seemed tailor-made for that one specific kind of operation that she needed, and not they weren't really tools that I think that were adaptable to all different types of things.
It actually had a claw like the claw that you would see in one of those machines where you drop the claw to get the plush doll.
The toy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it didn't have like an articulate hand type of thing that, you know, you'd have like this robot hand in there that was way more articulate than a human hand. It just come out with this stupid hook claw and plucked, you know, take something out of her body. Oh God, go ahead, Steve. I don't want to take the medical aspect.
That's all right. I mean, you're doing fine because it was that stupid. So it does essentially a cesarean section on her in order to extract this alien from her womb. And, you know, first of all, they didn't preclude the actual surgery with any automated diagnostics. Like, I'm sure it could have imaged her and found exactly what was done, an automatic diagnostic run. That would have been a nice little addition. And then, you know, it slices into her pretty much like you would today. Nothing laparoscopic, nothing, you know, more technological. It's this big claw descend, sort of grabs the thing by the head and pulls it out. There was no finesse. It looked like it was going to drop the thing. I mean, it really didn't look like a very sophisticated surgical attachment, you know. Mm-hmm. And then this is the worst part, though. This is the killer.
Yeah, this is bad.
So the surgery's done. Well, there's two bad things. So one is it pulls out the alien, and then she yanks the umbilical cord out of herself, right? So she detaches it from – so what is that umbilical cord connected to?
All her vitals.
Wouldn't it be connected to some kind of placenta?
Yeah.
So if you just yank out and detach an umbilical cord from a placenta inside of you, then you will bleed out fairly quickly. You can't leave a placenta inside of you and just yank the cord off.
But this is an alien.
But it would have been a nice little touch if she delivered the placenta too. I mean, or wouldn't the automated robot thing know, okay, now we have to get rid of the placenta as well.
Or at least sew it up or something.
Well, then the big thing is that in order to close this wound, so now it's cut through skin, subcutaneous tissue, fascia, abdominal muscle, and then the womb.
Cockles.
And then to close all of that up, it just staples her skin shut.
That was it.
Like I said, 2012 surgical technology.
At that point, she would need to lie in a hospital bed, even if like she didn't bleed to death, like Steve said. She gets up and does phenomenal feats of of athletics after that.
Running, jumping.
Her guts would be on the floor before she even got out of that.
Stapling the skin closed would not be enough to keep your abdomen shut. It would have been nice, technically they would have done at least three levels of suturing. You know, the womb, the abdominal muscle, probably another deep layer, and then the skin. So three or four layers of closure to really close that wound. They didn't do that. And the other thing is, it's 100 years in the future. Staples? Really? I mean, come on. I mean, I would have – would shoot some foam in there and have the healing lasers close it up. I mean, I would totally give them some hypothetical futuristic medical technology that allowed for – almost instantly close and be healed to the point where she could run around without spilling her guts all over the floor. But all it did was put in one external superficial layer of staples, and there was no appearance of any other advanced medical technology. And then she, as everyone said, she's running around, you know, wincing at her stomach, but running around. There's no way that she would have burst those staples wide open with what she was doing.
Yeah, but they were staples that are 100 years advanced, Steve. Come on.
It's not about the strength of the staples, you know. It's about holding your guts in with your skin, as opposed to all the layers of muscle and fascia that normally do it.
Garbage. Right. What else you got?
It was terrible. It was terrible.
Yet again, it's another cool idea that they totally trashed. It could have been so much better. I still enjoyed that scene just because the concept was just so awesome. But the execution was just like, oh, guys, come on, a little extra thought. You know, an extra $1,000 in your stupid budget, and you could have made it so much better.
Steve, I'm curious to know what you think in particular about why in this movie we don't connect with the characters and we don't care about the characters. Because that's always the kiss of death for a movie.
Yeah. Partly because, for example, with the geologist, what was his character? Who was this guy? First, he's a tough guy, I don't care. Then he's techno guy whipping out the laser balls. And then he's afraid, you know, of a dead body. And then he's stupid. I don't know. I don't know who this guy was. He had no consistent character.
He's grossly incompetent.
You know what I mean? I can't really describe him. You just like he was in every scene what he needed to be to clumsily push the plot forward, and there was nothing there to connect with. And the other characters, again, he was the worst in my opinion. But the other ones were flat in a lot of ways, and they didn't they were too stupid to really connect to. I thought they were so obviously plot devices. So when a character is a plot device, they're a red shirt. You're not meant to connect to them. You know, it's like everyone in this movie was a red shirt. They were just there it's like the teenager in a horror movie who does the really hello, is there somebody there? You know.
Yeah, I'm gonna go take a shower over here now. Bill?
Yeah, it's like you're there to be splattered. So I'm immediately not going to care about you because I already know that you're splatter fodder. That's why.
Yeah.
I always compare it to the characters in James Cameron's Aliens, the second Alien movie, because for me that's one of the science fiction epics, and I love the way he wrote his characters in that movie. Almost every one of them, either I loved them or I hated them, but I had a strong connection and emotion. But all these characters, I didn't like anybody in the entire movie except the one guy that wasn't a human. I didn't like any of the humans. Like, come on, pathetic.
Game over, man. Game over.
Yeah. I have the final comment, and I think you all will agree. An alien only shows up in the last 15 seconds of the movie.
An actual alien, yeah.
The whole movie was a setup.
Yeah, an actual one.
Crying out loud, yeah. Come on.
It seemed gratuitous. And like, okay, this is just supposed to get us excited for the next movie. You know.
Hey, but other than that, guys, this movie was great. Other than that 50 minutes, this was wonderful.
Well, now that that's done with, Bob, tell us why time is slowing down, and not just while you're watching the movie, Prometheus.
Yeah, this is a weird story. Some scientists have come up with a pretty wacky alternative explanation to the ever-increasing expansion rate of the universe. They say that this expansion is just an artifact and that it's being caused by time slowing down, as Steve said. But not only that, at some point in the far future, according to them, time could totally stop freezing the universe in its tracks. Now, you're probably thinking, what the hell are you talking about, Bob? What about dark energy, right? Well, yes, this, of course, runs counter to what scientists have called dark energy these past 20, 25 years or so. In the 90s, examinations of certain types of supernovae called Type 1A show that they were fainter than expected. And since all of these supernovae were all fainter than they should be based on their redshift, then they had to be farther away, meaning that the universe is expanding faster and not slowing down like everybody assumed at that time. So the energy or whatever it is that suffuses space to cause expansion is exactly what dark energy is. Now, this latest take on the apparent, I guess, expansion of the universe comes from Professor Sinovilla and there's a couple other guys, Mark Mars and Raul Vera. They're from the University of Basque Country Bilbao and the University of Salamanca, Spain. They say that we're looking at this whole effect backwards. The universe only appears to be expanding at an increasing rate. What might really be happening, according to them instead, is that time is slowing down. So when we look into our telescopes, we're looking into the past when time was moving at a faster rate.
Cool.
And it's this that's giving us the illusion, this artifact or illusion of increasing expansion. Humans can't notice time slowing down with our paltry human senses, of course, unless, of course, you know, you're watching the Jersey Shore or something like that. But many billions of years from now, the effect could be very dramatic. Professor Sinovilla says, then everything will be frozen like a snapshot at one instant forever.
I hope I'm doing something cool when that happens.
Yeah, right.
Not pulling some weird face or something.
Yeah, I know what I like to do. A lot of this just strikes me as being really silly, and the really frustrating thing is that I couldn't find too many useful details about this. A lot of what I found one thing that was really way too technical for my nano brain. But a lot of the stuff was written by people who clearly are more accustomed to writing about home gardening. It was really, I mean, I was really amazed at how pathetic some of these news items were. I got to throw you some quotes because my jaw just dropped with some of this stuff. At itechpost.com, they were saying that the theory of an expanding universe is based on the fact that planets appear to be moving away from us. Well, no, not planets. I mean, it's stars and, okay, you know, kind of like a, you know, just a mistake like that. It's not a typo. That's just like, wait, no, you got to do a little more homework before you write this.
I have no patience for people who don't know the difference between planets, stars, solar systems, galaxies, universes. There was like one cartoon from our youth. You guys remember this? Where like the intro was, together with the other, you know, the other civilizations of the solar system, they help protect the universe from other things in the galaxy. It's like they just were completely mixing it all up. Like it's just all random phrases referencing space, you know. Oh, I just hate that. I can't imagine walking around without having a reasonable working model of the universe in your head. You know, like how everything fits together, at least in a very basic way. I just don't get it.
I don't get it either. And what also gets me is that if you're not, people will say, oh, I don't care. How could you not care at the big picture, that kind of, that, you know, it just amazes me that people just don't care enough to get even a fundamental, you know, appreciation of stuff like that. But there's a couple more here. Right. The Telegraph said observations of supernovae or exploding stars found the movement of light indicated they were moving faster than those nearer to the center of the universe.
The center of the universe.
There is no center. Everything is the center of the universe. There is no place you could point to and say that is the center. So that was kind of sketchy. And the Daily Mail had a good one. The reports that scientists have used measurements of light from exploding stars millions of miles from Earth to show the universe. Wait a second.
Wait, at least 5 million miles from Earth, Bob. That's
The sun is more than million. It's 93 million. That was the one. That's millions of miles from Earth. Okay,
trillions
right,
of millions
whatever.
Of miles, sure, or something like that. But yeah.
Well, yes, right.
How about quadrillions or quintillions? Come on. Let's see. Oh, mailonline.com. Let's see. What do they have to say? It might sound difficult to believe, but a cosmologist at Cambridge University says the idea is not without substance. And here's his quote, and it struck me as too odd. We believe that time emerged during the Big Bang, and if time can emerge, it can also disappear. That's just the reverse effect. What? I'm having trouble.
Are they making this shit up?
See, they did not name this guy. They didn't even say his first name.
They misquoted
him
clearly. They must have.
I think they just made it up. I can't imagine any cosmologist from Cambridge University saying that. That just strikes me as like, no, it's just, the reverse effect. It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, how is time? Yeah, time could disappear since it appeared in the first place. Wait, space-time, it's the fabric of the universe. How is time?
That's probably a reporter butchering a quote from the scientist.
Well, yeah,
that's the most likely scenario. That they talked for an hour. They cherry-picked that one quote from him to plug into the story and they butchered it. That's by far and away the most likely thing that happened.
That's good work, boys.
If you put something in quotes, man, okay. So, I mean, I don't even have much more than that. And also, the other thing that kind of disappointed me was that I found a lot of talk on this specific theory that's like 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old. So I was like, oh, wait, this isn't really brand new stuff. This has been passed around for literally years. And the fact that I haven't really heard about any of this before and no one's really talking about it, makes me think, well, yeah, it just never really panned out. And for some reason, I don't know, I couldn't really figure out why. It's back in the news. I didn't
slow
see
news day.
That, yeah, it must have
no.
Been
they
slow
do
news
this.
Day.
The reporters they'll dredge stuff up from years ago and report it as if it's news.
It reminded me of a news story we talked about a couple years ago about time, the time dimension being replaced by another space dimension.
Yeah,
do you guys remember talking about that?
Wait, not another space.
Yeah, it was like the brain theory sort of stuff where they were, and it's another thing where, you know, that was like 4 years ago. I don't think I've seen anything about this since, but, so maybe it was another sort of flash in the pan suggestion, but it is cool to think about it because it forces you to realize that time isn't something that always was, or, and you can't even talk yeah. about time that way, like in terms of always, because, you know, every, like our language, the way we act, the way we understand things, it's all informed by the fact that we're subject to time. And so it's just, it's really a, what's a PG way to say
mind copulation. Mind coitus.
It's a mind screw. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of that before. I haven't specifically heard about doing away with time and adding another dimension of space, but I have heard of multiple dimensions of time, which is, I wouldn't know how that would work, but it sounds really cool to have, you know, how would that work? How would they, these two dimensions of time interact? Because the dimensions of space obviously can coexist, but I'm not sure how time would actually pull that off, but it would be cool if it's possible.
The one kernel of sort of reasonableness in this whole thing is that time is a variable. It's not a constant. It is relative. So it saying that we appear to be moving faster now than we did in the past, so we must be accelerating. Yeah, but it's true. You could manipulate other variables to get to that result, and you know, you could just say, well, maybe we're not accelerating. Maybe time is slowing down. It sounds crazy, but that's no crazier than saying light is a constant and space and time are variables, you know, the whole relativity thing. And just because, you know, theoretical cosmologists haven't done much with it in the last 4 years doesn't mean that it's been disproven or it's dead. It could be the kind of thing that takes decades, you know, to really think through.
I want a quickie with Bob.
I demand a quickie with Bob.
I don't want a quickie with Bob. Oh, okay.
Okay, so this is your quickie with Bob, and this is a quick update with the Higgs boson. It was in the news the past couple weeks. The Higgs boson is a particle that's supposed to imbue all matter with mass. The standard model of physics predicts it. It's like the one thing that it's major predictions that hasn't been found yet, and it looks like we're so close. We can taste it. Scientists will release their new data, their new discoveries that they've made at CERN regarding this next month during the International Conference on High Energy Physics in Melbourne, Australia. I'd love to be there. It's July 4th to July 11th, right before TAM, so maybe we'll have something interesting to talk to at TAM. There was a spokesman from CERN, James Gillies, said recently on July 4th we'll be able to say whether either there is nothing in the data this year or there are still hints in the data, but not strong enough for us to be able to say it's a discovery, and the other options at a possible discovery, he said. So either of these three things is possible. You know, perhaps they'll say, yep, we finally found the Higgs, and it's all good, and we're so confident we can announce the discovery. So that, of course, is the best case scenario. But maybe perhaps more likely they'll say something like, well, we've narrowed yet again the range of energies that the Higgs could be hiding in. That's another possibility, and it'd be okay, you know, that they're zeroing in even more, but you know, it's not the best news. And then, of course, there's also the possibility that they still could say, well, guys, after careful examination, you know, of the ATLAS and CMS data, last year's tantalizing results were just a statistical anomaly. That's possible, that they could discount the cool results they had last year. And that would be a big bummer. But who knows, that even that might point to some interesting new physics. But then again, you know, if you listen to some of these respected bloggers that have been talking about this, maybe we do have a right to be fairly confident that they're going to come out with some really awesome news next month. Mathematician Peter Voigt wrote in his blog, Not Even Wrong, he said, the bottom line, though, is now clear. There is something there which looks like a Higgs is supposed to look. So
all right.
Oh, boy.
So essentially, there may or may not be an announcement next month which may or may not have demonstrated the Higgs. Got it. All right. Let's move on.
This has been your Quickie with Bob.
Thanks,
I hope
Bob.
It was good for you.
Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Steve. Yes.
Nice try, Bob.
Who's That Noisy? So from two episodes ago, we had the baby rhinoceros. Remember that cute little noise the baby rhinoceros made? Nobody got that right. So cute though it may have been, it stumped the audience. So, but you know, go ahead, have a look online for baby rhinoceri. And they are cute. Okay, moving on. Last week's Who's That Noisy? And here we go.
There's no evidence of evolution from one species to another. There's microevolution within a species, but not going from one species to another.
I know that voice anywhere.
Yes, that purveyor of science
and evolution and good education, Miss Wendy Wright.
Wendy Wright.
Yeah. Rebecca, you guessed this one correctly.
Wendy Wright is wrong.
I did, and it's sad that, like, her, something about her voice just, you know, as soon as I heard it, I was like, oh, God, that terrible interview with Dawkins where she she, like, the stuff that comes out of her mouth.
First of all, she's the former president and CEO of Concerned Women for America, which is a conservative Christian political action group. She's apparently...
where three of the top five paid positions are men.
That is our...
Little fact for you about the Concerned Women of America.
She was once listed as one of the 100 most powerful women in Washington in 2006 by Washingtonian Magazine, which is a scary enough thought in itself. And you do have to go and you have to watch on YouTube the interview conducted by Richard Dawkins of Wendy Wright. And she's, you know, she's clueless as all get. She absolutely has no clue what science is. But at the same time, my impression is that this woman is very, very convincing in the sense that she handles herself very professionally. She sound to the uninformed and to neophytes when it comes to this thing, and to the ignorant, she comes off as being very intelligent. And very well spoken in a certain way. She never says or she never pauses. She never fumbles over her words. She has her lines. She has her rote down very, very well. And you can see how she could be a very influential person in a place like Washington, D.C., which, you know, pays very little attention to the science of the day, in my opinion. So it's fascinating to watch.
Got it.
Many, many correct answers. Apparently, this interview was watched by many of our listeners, which is a good thing. Belgarath from the message boards was the first one to guess correctly. So, well done, sir.
All right, well, what do you got for this week?
Okay, here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy? Here it comes. Okay, so what you heard was music, okay? That's clear enough to anybody, right? But this music is an interpretation of something scientific. That's your clue for this week. So you need to figure out, what is this representation? What does this music represent in the world of science?
Okay.
Give it your best shot. info@theskepticsguide.org is our email. And you could also guess on our forums, sguforums.com. Jump on the message boards and give us your thoughts. Good luck.
Thanks,
everyone.
Evan. Couple emails this week. The first one comes from Michael Denman from the United States. And Michael writes, I saw this article today and was absolutely amazed. I hope you're able to share it with your listeners. And he links to an article about how American fundamentalist schools are using the Loch Ness Monster prove that creationism is correct.
This is actually something I've heard in creationist circles before, although, I mean, the argument. This is the first time I've heard that it's being taught.
Yeah, so it's interesting because what they're talking about is the Accelerated Christian Education, or ACE, program, which is it's kind of like a curriculum, a Christian-based curriculum that is taught in religious schools in the United States, and some religious schools, and also is used by a lot of Christian homeschoolers. And it's interesting because I had the same reaction. There's a couple of arguments in there that I've heard from a number of different creationists, and now I know why, because they're all learning it from this accelerated Christian education textbook crap. So this is one. I looked into a little bit further, and there are people who went through this education and who are no longer believers who have reported on the content of these books and quoted from it directly. I guess they have copies of the book.
And that gives us a little hope, just to mention, you know, some people escape.
One website called Leaving Fundamentalism that has a couple of blog posts. One is the top five lies taught by accelerated Christian education. Number five is the Loch Ness Monster disproves evolution. Essentially, they say the Loch Ness Monster is a dinosaur, a plesiosaur, which is not a dinosaur, by the way. Plesiosaur is an aquatic reptile that lived at the time of the dinosaurs, but was not a dinosaur. It's like a pterodactyl.
This won't be the worst fact that they'll have gotten
yeah.
wrong, but okay.
It's like saying a pterodactyl is a dinosaur. Nope, it was a flying reptile, not a dinosaur. In any case, pterodactyls were not dinosaurs.
Nor were they birds.
Yes.
They were flying. They were their own order of flying reptiles that were contemporary
that's right,
to
like
the
Batman.
Dinosaurs. So what they say is, sometimes some scientists speculate that Noah took small or baby dinosaurs on the ark. Are dinosaurs still alive today? With some recent photographs and testimonies of those who claim to have seen one, scientists are becoming more convinced of their existence.
What?
Have you heard of the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland? Nessie, for short, has recorded on sonar from a small submarine described by eyewitnesses and photographed by others. Nessie appears to be a plesiosaur. There you go.
The hell scientists are they talking to?
If dinosaurs are contemporary to mankind, then evolution is wrong. That's the whole point there.
I'll give you that.
Wrong and wrong. Number four, and this is something that I've heard, I've argued with creationists about, didn't realize it was coming from this source. Solar fusion is a myth. The sun is not powered by solar fusion. It's powered by the energy of its collapse. The sun is shrinking. The reason why they like the idea of the sun shrinking is that if you extrapolate into the past, millions of years in the past, the sun would have gobbled up the earth. So it disproves the antiquity of the universe. Of course, the sun is not shrinking, it burns with a nuclear fuel. Number three is a Japanese whaling boat found a dinosaur.
Godzilla.
I love that one.
And some people say, are they confusing this with the movie Godzilla? But no, it's the decayed lump of flesh that you could see whatever you want in it that somebody pulled up. It's some animal that was rotting in the ocean.
I just love how matter-of-fact this statement is,
Yeah.
Fisherman found a dinosaur.
There you go.
Evolution is wrong. Don't ask questions. That's it. That's the fact.
Number two is evolution has been disproved. Okay, we know that one. And number one is humans and dinosaurs coexisted. This is interesting because they cite the Paluxy tracks, which have been disproved so thoroughly that even answers in Genesis will no longer cite it as evidence. But it found its way into the ACE textbook, and there it stays. And they apparently haven't updated it.
They're perhaps referring to that scientific show that was once on television called The Flintstones, in which humans and dinosaurs existed quite well together, yes.
So, unfortunately, yes, that is the quality of some fundamentalist education in the U.S., and apparently in the U.K. as well. It's not isolated to the U.S. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Now, we're in the pre-TAM phase where we have to get a few shows under our belt quickly so that we'll have the show done while we're in Vegas at the Amazing Meeting. So it makes it challenging to come up with multiple science or fictions, in the same week. So often I resort to doing some special themes, and I'm doing a special theme today. This is a fun one.
Okay.
Now, have you guys heard of the Wisdom of Chopra?
Is that the random generator?
Yeah, it doesn't help you that you've heard about it.
Damn.
So somebody has come up with a wonderful website called The Wisdom of Chopra that generates random phrases that are meant to
probably
sound
makes more sense than
like the kind
said.
Of wisdom that Deepak Chopra dispenses on his Twitter feed.
Oh, no. Well, I think we're about to try to figure that out.
What I have are four bits of wisdom. Three are from Chopra's actual Twitter feed. One I generated on the random phrase generator from the Wisdom of Chopra. You have to tell me which one of these four phrases was randomly generated from the other three actual things that Deepak Chopra has said on his Twitter feed. Okay, ready?
Maybe we should call Chopra and fiction instead of science or fiction.
Or Chopra.
Because there's clearly no science this week, folks.
Fiction or fiction, right? Here we go.
That sounds like
item number one. Awareness is the birthplace of possibility. Item number two, to know the world, feel your body.
God damn
it. Oh, yes. Feel it every night.
Ooh.
Item number three.
Oh, there's the world again.
Established in being, perform action. And item number four, knowledge is the path to your own positivity. Jay, go first.
All right. So this awareness is the birthplace of possibility. I got to say that that sounds so much like him that the website is either fantastic or that's him. Second one, to know the world, feel your body. You are a filthy man, Deepak. There's so many things I could say about that, but not on this show. And then the third one is established in being, perform action. And that is the exact type of pseudoscientific crap that comes flying out of his mouth every day. And finally, the last one, knowledge is the path to your own positivity. Wow. Oh, this is just a total crapshoot, man. I'm going to say that knowledge is the path to your own positivity is the fake.
All right, Bob?
I'm going to go against all my instincts and agree with Jay.
Okay.
You suck, Bob.
Evan?
So three are Chopra and one's the generator?
Yep.
Boy, he is he's an unimpressive human being, isn't he? I can't believe
he made $22 million in 2008.
Yep. Gosh.
It's incredible.
He may have made it, but he certainly didn't earn it. I will say that established in being, perform action. That is the regenerated one.
Okay. Rebecca?
Yeah, that's the one I was going to go with as well. It's the only one that's not a full sentence. Not that I think that we can rely on Chopra to consistently create full English sentences, or actually any other language full sentences. But having used the generator, it does tend to pump out the occasional...
Too obvious.
Non-grammatical
okay.
sentence, so I'm going to go with
two
that
and two. So you all agree that Deepak Chopra said, awareness is the birthplace of possibility. And
oh, gosh.
Chopra did say that. That's from his Twitter feed.
One in three.
Good job.
Hooray.
All right. The next one, to know the world, feel your body.
Yes.
And that one, Chopra did say that one.
Excellent. My boy.
Now,
one and two.
He must masturbate every day.
He's talking about the whole interconnectedness of you and the universe, that whole Eastern philosophy thing about everything's connected and you are
yes,
the trees.
Exactly.
And it's like the forest, the rock and the trees. And so, yeah, so if you to know the universe, all you have to do is know your own body.
Yoda is 10 times more prolific than Chopra ever was.
That's right.
At least 11 times.
Lived until his 800s or something, right?
Yes.
So, two of you are right and two of you are incorrect. Did Chopra write established in being, perform action?
No. Perform action now, sir!
Yes, he did. That is a Chopra phase.
Yay! He did.
All right, Bob. Good job, Bob.
High five, wisdom generator pumped out
God
knowledge
damn
is
it.
The path to your own positivity. Yeah. I did have too many. I mean, all of the ones that I did when I was
That's a good one.
Here, I'm at the website now. I could generate some more.
Positivity is what sold me on
your
that
heart
one, it was
is only possible him. In positive space-time events. That was not that good.
Space-time.
Interdependence grows through the flow of photons.
Yeah, the guy's a poet. You know what I mean? He just...
God explains existential belonging. This is his Twitter feed. He doesn't have to work anymore. He can just hook his Twitter feed up to this. Love comprehends reckless potentiality.
You picked the best one, Steve, because all those other ones suck.
You don't expect people to swallow this trick.
I thought it was a brilliant idea. The wisdom of Chopra.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. I think we should use this at TAM. We should poll the audience. I'd love to see what they think.
What we need to do is come up with our own mechanism for a random generator.
Yeah.
Random Egnor generator.
Yeah. It was some
random creationist generator.
On Skeptic, I used to occasionally do quizzes, and my favorite was called Oprah or Chopra. It was very difficult.
Oh, my God.
A lot difficult
awesome.
Than you might think.
Oprah Chopra.
Good. Oh, actually, I got it wrong. It was actually Oprah Chopra or the Popra. So you had to guess which is which. They were really difficult.
That reminds me of a game that's also exceedingly difficult, and that's Shakespeare or the Bible. Have you guys ever played that?
Yeah, ooh, yeah.
It's no, really tough. Lots of common cliches, you know, that we toss around there, and the question: did this come from Shakespeare or the Bible? And it's hard.
Yeah, and there's a reason why a lot of people say that Shakespeare wrote the King James Bible or whatever, you know. Some of it does sound very Shakespeare-ish.
Yeah, I mean, to us, it's all
Shakespearean.
Shakespeare-ish.
Shut up.
It would be a Shakespeare conspiracy.
Right. If you believe in William Shakespeare.
No, he didn't exist.
One guy could
saw that in a movie.
Jay, you have a quote for us?
I do, but it's not really a quote. It's this week I want to try to redeem the fact that Prometheus sucks so bad, and I want to read the following. I'm going to assign characters to some of you, and we're going to read this because this happens to be the best dialogue from the movie Alien and my favorite part of the entire movie.
Ash, can you hear me? Ash.
Yes, I can hear you.
What was your special order?
You read it. I thought it was clear.
What was it?
Bring back life form. Priority one. All other priorities rescinded.
Damn company. What about our lives, you son of a bitch?
I repeat, all other priorities are rescinded.
How do we kill it, Ash? There's got to be a way of killing it. How? How do we do it?
You can't.
That's bullshit.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it.
I admire its purity. A survivor, unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality.
Look, I've heard enough of this, and I'm asking you to pull the plug.
Last word.
What?
I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies.
Oh, man, that scene
is Ian
so
Holm,
good.
Ian Holm, totally delivered.
That was a great quote.
Thank you, Bob.
It's really natural, Bob.
All right, I have a couple of quick announcements, of course. It's not too late. Go to TAM. It's going to be a good year, and it's going to be exceptionally good because we're having the Skeptics Poker tournament. You could go to skepticspoker@gmail.com to pre-reg, and we will take care of all the payment arrangements when you get there. Really hope that you join us.
And don't forget, we also have the SGU dinner Friday night. The four guys will be there, and we will have an auction afterwards, including auctioning off a guest rogue spot on the SGU. So don't miss your opportunity. All right. Well, thanks for joining me again, everyone, this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, no problem.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.